History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. That's what we've learned. If we're just willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then exercise enough patience to allow some eye-opening responses to rise to the surface, we might just end up with a whole new perspective. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we truly are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we're going to hear from a 96-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge, as well as a little bit from his wife of 75 years. But before we get to Phil Wright's story, I want to take at least a moment to recognize the significance of this weekend and the 20th anniversary of the tragic events of September 11th, 2001. What happened in that field in Pennsylvania, at the Pentagon, and of course at the World Trade Center, is something that none of us who were alive for that will ever forget. It's very similar in that regard to the folks we hear from on this program, remembering December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor. We all recall where we were and how we found out. A couple of thoughts on that front before we dive in with our World War II veteran guest today. First, since it's been 20 years, there are probably some younger people in your life who weren't born yet when the rest of us had our world rocked so violently 20 years ago. How about taking a few minutes this weekend to share your memories with them and explain in your words why September 11th, 2001 is a date we should never forget? And while you're at it, try to remember the spirit that arose in this country in the days that followed, how we saw the lines of division dissipating, the resolve that emerged, and of course the unity that was fostered throughout our nation. The veteran we have the privilege of visiting with today is Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California. That's quite a ways from where he grew up. But thanks to his Army service in World War II, nearly two decades more in the Air Force during the era of the Korean War, the Cold War, and the Vietnam War, really he's lived all over the world. We're going to hear what he remembers about the Battle of the Bulge, how he met his wife of 75 years, Hazel, and even how he ended up on a few joyrides with the legendary ace Chuck Yeager. But as always, we want to start out with the early years. So what do you remember about your childhood back east, Phil?
Well, the simple life. I had four brothers and a sister. My dad was an alcoholic. He drove a truck. It seemed like he was in a wreck every week. So we had an average childhood.
How'd you get along with all those siblings?
We got along well. I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, in a town called Elkton, E-L-K-T-O-N. Our childhood was very simple.
Did you have a lot of chores around the house?
We always had chores. We had chores that lasted from the time we got home from school until our dad got home. He didn't want us playing very much with the other kids. He wanted us doing something around the house. My dad always made sure we had enough chores to do.
Do you remember as a boy having some hopes, some dreams, some ambitions of, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do?
No, I didn't. I just grew up as an average child and didn't have any ambitions at that time. I had an average childhood, except for the whippings that I got every day. My dad whipped us every day with a razor strap. Every day. When he got home, that was the first thing he did, was whipped us with a razor strap, whether you deserved it or not. He would say he was going to give us a whipping just in case he heard something.
That had to be a pretty difficult reality to live with.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Because you didn't know what he was with. He would tell you he had heard that day. Since he was an alcoholic.
Did that make you want to get out of the house?
Wanted me make me leave home, and I did. I guess I was 17. I just finished high school.
Well, and there was something that happened while you were in high school that everybody around your age I seem to talk to usually has a memory about December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor and how they found out about it. Do you remember what you were doing or how you found out?
Well, very soon after that, I was drafted into the Army.
And how'd you feel about going into the Army?
Well, I had no feelings about it. It was the thing everybody was doing, so it was just normal. I had friends in the service before I was drafted.
And what did they do with you?
Camp Lee, Virginia is where I did my early time in the service.
What do you remember about that? Were there some challenging aspects of that?
Well, there was always challenges, but the life in the service was good then.
Was it eye-opening at all? Did you start to get exposed to some things you hadn't been exposed to before?
Oh, I'd never been exposed to life like that. So it was different, but it didn't take long to get adjusted to the Army life.
So from Camp Lee, where'd you go from there?
Waycross, Georgia. We went on maneuvers in Georgia in the swamps. It's pretty damp down there.
I'm sure there's no bugs or anything, though, right?
Oh, they were all over the place.
Had you ever fired any kind of weapon before?
Nothing, other than a shotgun. You know, we used to go hunting for rabbits and squirrels.
So what all did they train you on in the Army?
Well, they just gave us an M1 rifle and got us trained on the rifle range. I think everybody that was in our squadron was from the state of Virginia and had been used to guns and so forth. So we had no problems firing rifles and qualifying and to be a marksman or whatever it was we were training for.
And how did you feel about the prospect of getting sent overseas? Because this war's been going on for a couple of years now. It's still going on. How did you feel about that idea of you going across the pond?
It didn't bother me at all. I sort of enjoyed going overseas at the time.
I'm curious. You go overseas. Had you ever been on a ship before that?
Oh, no. No, I'd never been on water before.
So what was that like?
Well, it was a big ship, you know, a troop ship, a lot of people on it. I got off the ship, I was overseas.
Did you get seasick at all along the way?
I never got seasick. Nope, didn't bother me at all.
So they put you in the 567th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery. What was your job?
My job when I was on the gun was I transferred ammunition from the boxes to the guns.
And what kind of guns were those?
And quad 50s and 40mm anti-aircraft gun.
So the idea is if German planes are heading toward your position, you guys are going to hop on those guns and try to shoot them down.
Yeah, we did.
And where were you?
Le Havre, France. And from there, I don't know where all I went. I was all over Europe at that time. We transferred from one job to another with anti-aircraft guns. We were either protecting ammunition dumps, aircraft. We did all kinds of jobs.
And I believe you got there at winter time, right?
Yes, we did. It was very cold.
So everybody's heard about the Battle of the Bulge and how cold it was.
Yeah, I was in the Battle of the Bulge. I was in Bastogne, Belgium during that time.
One of the absolute worst places to be.
You're absolutely right. It was bad. When we were in Bastogne, Belgium, we lived in a foxhole. We did not live in a house. We were always in a foxhole, something we dug ourselves and stayed underground.
And I can't imagine it was very easy to dig that foxhole given how frozen the ground was.
That's right. It was pretty cold, pretty frozen. But we survived okay.
Can you put in perspective for us how cold it really was?
No, not really, but it was so cold. We wrapped our feet in a blanket or strips of blankets to keep warm. That was the way we kept warm during the winter time.
And I've heard some horror stories about what guys went through in those conditions. Their feet would get wet if they weren't able to change their socks. Their feet would freeze.
Yeah.
Did you deal with any of that?
I did not have to deal with any of that. I was pretty fortunate there.
So you never got any frostbite on your fingers or your toes?
No, never got any frostbite. We always stayed warm.
I thought I remembered you telling me that your big toe turned black at one point.
Well, it froze. What that? Everybody's toes froze.
See, for us, that's a big deal. That's never happened to us. But
yeah, I guess so.
So does that go numb or is it painful?
It was then. Not now. I've gotten over all of that. We were freezing and we got very little food. We got enough to survive on, but it was tough during those days. We always hoped for the best, but you never knew what was going to happen. You know, we were just GIs in the Army at that time. We survived it all.
And when you're in a foxhole, and you know there's Germans not too far away, whose artillery might be coming in on you at any minute, and you're a teenager, and you're on the other side of the world from home, what do you think about in that foxhole?
Your girl's back home. You're just waiting for your next letter from home. Hazel and I were writing to each other.
If I try to imagine myself in your shoes, in Bastogne, during the Bulge, living in a foxhole with not a whole lot to keep warm, knowing the enemy's out there, I might be a little frightened, a little scared. How about you?
Well, I think we were all scared at that time. They were always bombarding us with anti-aircraft with artillery. So we got used to it.
Were those the infamous 88s?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You could see the 88s flying through the air. That's a pretty big shell.
I've talked to a lot of veterans who have told me, too, that they still have nightmares about the sound of those 88s.
Yeah, they had a different sound all of their own, and you knew when it was coming in because you could hear it, and you knew exactly what it was, the 88s. They were pretty powerful.
Yeah, that was my next question. Did you witness some of the destruction that they could achieve with those?
Oh, yeah. They'd knock buildings down, you know, with those 88s. But I was usually in the country, though. I wasn't in towns very much. Very rarely was in a town. We were always out in the country somewhere.
How close did enemy artillery come to you?
Oh, within rifle distance. I was fired at, and I fired at them.
Got your attention, huh?
All the time.
And you mentioned earlier when I asked you about, you know, what you guys had as your anti-aircraft guns, and you said you had the 40 millimeters and the quad 50s. And I said, well, and then, you know, the planes would come in and you'd shoot at them. You said, yeah, that's what we did. Do you have some specific memories of some of those incidents where German planes are coming in and you guys are trying to shoot them down?
Oh, yeah. We had that every day.
Help me understand what that's like. What does it take to be successful in shooting down one of those German fighters?
Well, it's mostly luck.
How many men are on that gun?
Six. Six men was on a 40 millimeter cannon and quad 50s. One person was on the quad 50s, and there was about six men on a 40 millimeter anti-aircraft gun.
So help me understand what you're doing in that situation. If you know there's incoming aircraft and you guys are scrambling to be able to shoot it down, what are you doing at each moment along the way?
Passing ammunition. That's all we were doing. From our foxholes, we would go out and pick up ammunition and take it to the anti-aircraft guns and try to get back to safety again.
And I imagine those planes that are coming in are letting a few things fly too, huh?
Oh, yeah. They were all trying to kill us, but most of us survived it. We had a few people who got killed, not too many.
Were any of those people who you had gotten to know?
Oh, yeah. I knew a lot of people that were killed. There was a lot of people I knew when I was in the service that were friends of mine as civilians.
I don't want to try to make you talk about anything you're not comfortable talking about, but one of the things that's happening right now is there's a group of volunteers across the country who are trying to come up with a biography, a story to tell for every one of the 406,000 Americans who died in World War II. So they're looking for information about, you know, individual names and anything that anybody knows about them. And you said you knew a lot of guys who didn't come home. Do you remember any of their names?
Only one, really. His name was Mott Roberts, and he was killed. But most of us survived.
What happened to him?
He got hit with a mortar. He was in a foxhole, and it hit him right head on, so he didn't last but a moment, and he was gone. The majority of the people in my organization were from the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, so we knew the majority of the people in our organization from kids. We grew up together.
How well did you know Mott Roberts?
Mott Roberts, I only got to know him after we got in the service. He was from Roanoke, Virginia. He was a good guy. He got killed during the war.
And I'm just, again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. And guys like Mott Roberts are getting killed pretty much in the same position as you are, in a foxhole. It could happen to anybody at any time.
Anytime.
How did you process that as a teenager? How did you endure that reality that something like that could happen to you?
Well, you just hoped you had your foxhole at a place where it didn't hit you.
So I'm taking inventory here of some of the things that you've shared so far that could have taken you out, that could have killed or injured you.
Oh, yeah.
We've got the 88s, mortar shells, the weather, that could have gotten you. What else? What else did you have to be concerned with that could end your life?
Well, anti-aircraft, or rather artillery. We were continually bombarded with artillery from the Germans.
And what about their aircraft? Were their bombers ever targeting you guys?
We were targeted all the time.
The time right now is break time, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California. What does he remember about the end of the war in Europe? And what's the real story behind his 75 years of marriage? We may need his wife Hazel's help on that one. You can find photos of the Wrights then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. And we'll be right back after this.
If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down. 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes. From the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner. Or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California. Originally from Elkton, Virginia, during World War II, he served with the 567th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion, Battery C, in case you're wondering. His birthday is New Year's Day, January 1st, so all those years ago, he spent both Christmas and his 20th birthday in frozen foxholes during the Battle of the Bulge. For the months that followed, he would help pass ammunition for anti-aircraft guns in Belgium, France, and Germany, often engaging in small arms fire against the enemy as well. And by May 8, 1945, word came that Nazi Germany had surrendered. You remember where you were on VE Day, Phil?
I was in Germany at that time.
Was that significant?
At that time it was to us. In reality, we didn't really know everything that was going on. We just knew our little bit of the war.
And when you say you didn't know everything that was going on, at what point did you become aware of what was happening in all those concentration camps that the Nazis had?
I did not know what was going on. I did not know. Those guys had a pretty terrible life.
What would you say was the hardest thing you had to deal with in those years?
I guess being away from home.
Did you ever have days you weren't sure if you were going to ever make it home?
Oh, yeah. Oh, every day. We were shot at every day, either by rifle fire or anti-aircraft.
So when you heard that news that Germany had surrendered and the war in Europe is over, was there some celebration that took place there, or what was that like?
Oh, yeah. That night, well, you know, everybody was firing their guns and doing different things, but the majority of the soldiers were pretty calm at that time.
You know, and when we talked about the Battle of the Bulge, there's a couple things that usually come up. The cold is oftentimes the first.
Oh, it was cold. It was so cold. We wrapped our feet and our legs with anything that we could wrap them in and still get our shoes on. But it was cold, very cold that winter.
A lot of shivering?
A lot of it. A lot of shivering.
And the other thing that usually comes up is the casualties, the number of Americans killed and wounded.
Oh, yeah. I knew a lot of the guys that was killed that day or killed then.
How hard was that to face that reality every day?
At that time, it was just another day of the war. Either you got shot or somebody else on the other side got shot. I don't know how many people I shot. I shot at a lot of people. Maybe I missed them, I don't know. Hope so.
And when the war in Europe ended, was there any thought in your mind that you might be getting sent to the Pacific?
No. I didn't know where I was going to go. They sent me to New York. Came right by the Statue of Liberty.
Did that mean something to you?
At that time it did, yeah. You were home.
And if we look at it from the big picture, right? You're one of 16 million Americans who's serving in this war. And if you hadn't done what you did and Germany had won, our world would be a lot different today. Do you take some pride in that, in being a part of that effort?
Well, yeah, every day. You think about it every day.
And I know it's been a long time, but if you can go back to when you came home from the war. So now the war's over, you're back home, you got a lot of life in front of you. What do you think your mindset or your outlook was at that point?
Oh, I wanted to meet a girl and get married. I think that was the main thing that was on my mind.
And I guess you did.
Yeah, I met my wife through a friend of mine. I worked at Glen L. Martin from the time I was in high school and until I was drafted. I met this man from Pennsylvania, and he gave me the name of my wife, Hazel, and he told me I should write to her. She was a real nice girl that he had known when he was a kid, when we were kids, all kids growing up, you know, 17 or 18. So I corresponded with my wife. I don't know how long, maybe she would know.
She says 3 years.
Yeah, about that.
Tell you what, I'm just thinking here. What if I give you a break for a few minutes and let me get her side of the story of how you met? Is that all right?
Yeah.
And then we'll come back and talk about the Air Force?
Yeah.
That all right? Okay. So, Hazel, how did this lifelong romance begin? Can you give it to us from your perspective?
My friend was going to go down to Baltimore to Glen L. Martin to work, and Phil was there already. In the meantime, after he'd been down there for a while, he was drafted. And so Frank said, here's an address of a young lady that you might write to while you're in the service. So we wrote back and forth for 3 years.
And you hadn't even met him in person yet?
No, I had not met him in person. He came home and found out the girl he was engaged to married his cousin. That was a sad thing for him to find out. But one thing and another, after so long a time that he saw all of his girlfriends back there, he decided to give me a call, and I wanted to know if he could come up to see me. I was in Lewistown, Pennsylvania, a long ways off.
And when you two were writing letters to each other during the war, what kinds of things would you write about?
Well, it's kind of a little personal.
All right.
You know, you write and tell them all the things that's happening around the place and what's going on. That's about it.
Were you ever, I mean, that's 3 years is a long time.
Yeah. You know, it's a shame for him to be too far away from home and not have anybody there.
Did you at least know what each other looked like? Did you send each other pictures or anything?
I don't recall ever getting any pictures from him.
He gets home from the war. You've never met him before, and he comes up to see you. What were you expecting?
Well, I was only 17, and of course I didn't drive yet. And so I asked my dad if he would take me to the bus station, and of course we did. Everybody laughs about having my father pick him up from the bus station, and one thing led to another. Maybe months after he had been there or a year, my sister got married. He said, I wished it were us. So that was our proposal.
How romantic.
Very.
I've got to ask you, too, what was your first impression of him? Because you've been writing him letters, but you've never met him. So he shows up in your hometown. Your dad goes with you to pick him up. What'd you think of him when you met this guy?
I thought it was pretty nice. Yeah. We hit it off right away because we seemed to know each other after writing. You know, I thought I knew him.
So how much longer was it till you guys got married?
I honestly don't know how much longer, but we were married in 46, and I think my sister was married in 45.
Just a year after the war ends, you guys are married, and how old were you?
I was 17, but that was in July, and in October I was 18. He was 21. In January he was 22.
So that was 75 years ago. What's the secret to staying married for 75 years?
What is the secret, Phil?
Tell just love. I love you.
Yeah, give him a good night's kiss and see him in the morning.
And whose idea was it for Phil to go into the Air Force?
Oh, his idea. But he asked me if he could. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes. It would be a good idea, and it was the best idea that we ever had, because a lot of our friends weren't eating regularly or doing but we were sure to have regular food, regular pay, and it was good.
And how did you like being an Air Force wife?
I liked it. He would go TDY, and we'd have to wait for him to come back, and we moved every 3 years. So it's readjustment, but we saw a lot of the country, but it was in Europe. We never went to the Southeast Asia or any place like that.
I would imagine that after 75 years of marriage, you know him better than anybody else does, right?
I believe so. I know him very well. He's always there for me. If I need something, he will do it.
So some people would say it's awfully foolish to get married when you're 17 years old and it's not going to last.
Well, yes, they say that, and they also say, you had to get married, didn't you? No, we did not. 3 years later, we had our first child. Yeah.
So it has lasted 75 years and counting. So what advice would you have for the rest of us who would like our marriages to last that long?
Just give and take. It has to be both of you, right?
And as Phil's head is nodding in agreement, I'm going to slide back over to him, because after hearing that story from Hazel, I've got a few more questions for you. I'm curious, when you're that teenager in a frozen foxhole in the Battle of the Bulge and beyond, what did it mean to you when mail call arrived and you got a letter from Hazel?
Well, it made you feel pretty good. You knew that she was waiting for you to get home. Well, you were looking for the mail every day, looking for a letter every day. Didn't get one every day, but you wanted one. So that it was just a matter of waiting.
Am I inferring correctly that getting a letter from Hazel would maybe help you take your mind off other things?
Well, naturally, it took your mind off of the war. That was a tough war. World War II was a pretty tough war in Europe.
And I asked her, now let's get your side of the story. So you come to the bus station, and here's this 17-year-old girl with her father. What was your first impression?
Well, I thought she was a pretty nice girl, good-looking girl. And I think she wanted to get married right away.
Did anybody tell you it was a bad idea?
No. It was a mutual understanding that we were in love, and we were going to get married. One day, we would get married.
So that day was July 10th, 1946, and now we're in 2021, 75 years later. So how do you account for that?
Well, just we got along mutually. We got along real well together before we got married and after we got married.
And even still, after 75 years of marriage, it is time for our final break, but there's still plenty of ground to cover with 96-year-old Phil Wright, including how he got to know a guy who had become an ace in the skies above, where Phil and his 567th Anti-Aircraft Battalion buddies were shooting down enemy aircraft too. We're talking about the one and only Chuck Yeager. Don't forget to check out hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with Phil, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 96-year-old Phil Wright of Madera Ranchos, California, originally from Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, where he grew up as the oldest of six children. We heard about his World War II experience with the 567th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion and how he met his wife of 75 years now, Hazel. But after World War II, while working multiple shifts in a rayon mill back east, Phil decided that maybe some of his other talents might serve the family better. If you were to go visit him today and realize your watch had stopped ticking, he'd probably be able to take it apart and make it good as new. Those mechanical repair inclinations have been with him for decades, and in 1948, he realized they might come in handy for the U.S. Air Force. So with Hazel's blessing, he investigated the possibility of returning to the military life.
Well, I was a watch repairman at that time, and so they assured me that I would get into the instrument repair field. So that's what I did. I was an instrument repairman in the Air Force.
What kind of instruments on what kind of planes?
All kinds of airplanes. Of course, back in those days, you know, the most of the instruments were mechanical. You know, they were not electric or did not have electric. Most of them were manually operated. So I had a pretty good field. It was pretty good. I advanced real well in the Air Force. I went from being an airman for second class, I think I was at that time, to the grade of master sergeant. Then I became an E-8, which is one grade above a master sergeant.
Well, and that covers a lot of years. Of course, you had the Korean War, quite a few years there where the Cold War was heating up. Then, of course, the Vietnam War. And I know they sent you to Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, where we have some folks listening today on KIVA, the Rock of Talk, as they call it, in northern New Mexico. I don't know that we have any listeners in Morocco, but I understand you ended up in Casablanca.
Yeah, we spent 3 years there, didn't we?
What kind of planes were you working on at the time?
B-29s, B-25s. Well, they'd have a problem with an instrument. I would either have to go out to the aircraft, troubleshoot it, decide what the problem was, whether I could replace that instrument or whether I could repair the problem and get the aircraft back in service.
Did you ever have to go up into any of those planes to calibrate those instruments?
No, I never was a flyer.
How would you explain the importance of the job you were doing? What was the impact of what you were doing?
Well, I was just there to maintain the aircraft instrument systems and keep the aircraft in the air.
I guess maybe the way to ask the question is, if you didn't do your job correctly, what would the consequences be?
Well, that aircraft wouldn't fly.
If an altimeter's not working right, they may crash into the ground. I don't know if you saw it this way at the time, but it kind of sounds like that's a lot of responsibility. There are lives that are dependent on you doing your job right.
Yeah, we had good working conditions.
And at one point, I think you told me you ended up at Edwards Air Force Base where a bunch of the test pilots were.
Yeah, I was assigned to the test pilot school. And at that time, it was Chuck Yeager, and he was one of the main guys in the Air Force. And of course, I knew Chuck Yeager real well. Flew with him.
What kind of guy was he then?
Oh, he was just a fighter pilot.
Very confident?
Oh, yeah. Always. They're always confident. Those guys are always. They always think they know what they're doing.
So does that mean you were working on some of the instruments on some of these experimental, developmental planes?
Yeah, a lot of them. Early aircraft. Just flying normal missions. And they had targets that they were practicing with or on. So I was helping prepare the aircraft for a mission that they would be flying.
Well, and I got to ask you this because, you know, before when we talked about your Casablanca assignment, you said, no, I never went up in the aircraft. But you just told me that you flew with Chuck Yeager, one of the legendary aces of our country's history. So how did that happen? How did that come about?
If the back seat was open in an aircraft and we all had parachutes, we could get in the back seat and fly with the pilot. And I used to fly with Chuck Yeager a lot. We did a lot of things that wasn't really kosher.
Such as?
Well, flying up into the mountains in a P-51, landing on an airbase and going hunting or doing whatever we wanted to do.
This is a two-seat P-51?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that a bit of an adrenaline rush for you?
No, not really. But by then, I've been flying quite a bit. Didn't have an adrenaline rush then. I did when I first started flying, but it soon became a whole stuff, you know.
I got to ask, if I do the math, you know, by then, you've got a wife at home, and I think you're a father by now, too. So did you tell Hazel about flying with Chuck Yeager, or did you keep that to yourself?
We didn't talk much about the pilots that we flew with.
You think she might not have been a fan of that?
She may not have been.
If you're flying with test pilots, those probably aren't boring flights. There's probably a lot going on, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of test pilots there. I could fly with any pilot I wanted to fly with, but I just happened to be flying with Chuck Yeager a lot.
Was he doing some tricks?
Oh, yeah, he was always doing aerobatics in the air. We got along real good.
And you told me when you went overseas in World War II on that troop ship, first time you've ever been on the water, you said you didn't get seasick.
Yeah.
What about doing aerobatics with Chuck Yeager? Did you get a little sick with that?
No, never did. Never got sick with Chuck Yeager flying.
Chuck Yeager, of course, had become a double ace during World War II, shooting down 13 enemy aircraft, including 5 in a single day. By the time Phil Wright was spending time with Yeager at Edwards Air Force Base in California's Mojave Desert, Chuck had become the first pilot to break the sound barrier. We wouldn't have time, of course, to list all of Yeager's aviation accomplishments, but in the late 1960s, he flew 127 missions over Vietnam. Phil Wright's final years in the Air Force included his own trip to Southeast Asia during that time period.
I was sent to Thailand, maintaining the aircraft. Yeah, we were just into jets then. Changed our everything we did when they changed it over to the jets. It changed everything we were doing. Of course, they were faster, but they didn't fly as far. Those jets didn't have enough fuel to fly too awfully far away. But we maintained them, kept them flying.
So again, if I'm doing the math, so it's the Vietnam War. You spend a whole year at an airbase in Thailand maintaining these aircraft, and you've got a wife and 2 teenagers back home in the States. How hard was that for you?
Well, it was difficult being away from your children, but we got along okay.
And I know we talked about everything you went through in Europe during World War II. Being there in Thailand at an airbase, were there ever situations where you guys were in danger?
No, not in Thailand.
You know, we talked about World War II, and you told me about your friend Mott Roberts, who was killed. All your years in the Air Force, dealing with all those pilots and test pilots and air crews, were there ever times where you had to deal with losing somebody you knew?
We lost a lot of people we knew, a lot of test pilots. Someone was crashing, getting killed. That was just part of the getting along with the pilots. And they were being killed, but we all survived, all the ground crews.
How much guts do you think it takes to be a test pilot?
It takes quite a bit, knowing that the flight they're on may be their last flight. And so you had to think about that every day. We had a lot of respect for our test pilots. And I knew a lot of the young test pilots. I used to fly with them all the time. A lot of test pilots were killed during that time because they were doing maneuvers with those aircraft that was not supposed to be done, you know.
And maybe there's something I didn't ask you. Is there anything else about life in the Air Force for all those years that you look back on fondly or that you're thankful for?
You're thankful you survived it. Because there were many aircraft crashes that you could have been involved in, that I could have been involved in, but I wasn't. I think about those days. It's all passed over now.
Something else I want to ask you about. I think you probably have some good memories from this. A little more recently, a few years back, you got to go with a bunch of other veterans and your granddaughter and your great-grandson to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight to see the World War II Memorial and the Korean War Memorial and the Vietnam Memorial, and you were in the service for all three of those conflicts. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was nice to see some of those guys again. We had a lot of memories together. We were always pretty good.
Well, that better be the way it is. And I have another question for you about your Honor Flight experience. But while we're on that topic, I've been getting a lot of questions lately about Honor Flight and when veterans will again be able to take those free trips to Washington, really paid for decades ago with their selfless service. The answer is Honor Flight hubs in the eastern United States have resumed their one-day trips. It's a little harder from the West Coast given COVID concerns over a three-day experience. But Honor Flight Kern County out of Bakersfield will actually be taking a plane full of veterans in this week ahead. So if you're one of those loyal Hometown Heroes listeners who finds this program on KNZR radio in Kern County, you'll have a chance to greet those heroes when they return from their Honor Flight. In this COVID era, organizers there had the creative idea of holding their welcome home event outdoors instead of in the airport. Not far from the airport there in Bakersfield is Turk Eliadis Field at North High School. Named for a World War II fighter pilot and POW who shared his story on this show, by the way. But more importantly, he coached football at that school for decades. And that stadium at North High is where you can welcome home that Honor Flight Kern County collection of veterans spanning from World War II to the Vietnam generation. Try to get there by 7:30 on Thursday night, September 16th, and I promise you will not regret it. Again, that's for those of you listening in Kern County this weekend or really anywhere within driving distance of Bakersfield, California. So back to Phil Wright and his Honor Flight experience. I'm really interested to know what was going through your mind, Phil, at the National World War II Memorial, where they have the pillars for your home state of Virginia and the state where you've spent most of your life, California. They have those 4,000 gold stars representing over 406,000 Americans who never made it home from World War II. What was at the forefront of your mind when you were there on that hallowed ground?
The ones that didn't make it. You always thought about the ones that didn't get back.
How should those men be remembered?
Well, they were very, very brave men. But we all had a job to do, and most everybody did their job and did it well.
Yeah, I don't want to put thoughts in your head or make something that's not there. But I'm just wondering, while you're standing at those memorials in Washington, D.C., particularly the World War II Memorial, where you had friends who were killed and you knew it could have been you, and you've got your granddaughter and your great-grandson, neither of whom would have ever been born if you didn't come home from that war. Did that strike you at all? Did you think about that, how different things might have been?
No, not really, not at that time. But we had a good time on it on our flight.
How did that welcome home make you feel?
Well, it made you feel pretty good. We were all glad to get home.
I'm just wondering, because we talked about how during the war, what it meant to you to get a letter from this teenage girl who would end up your wife of 75 years. When you were on the honor flight and you were coming home and they called out mail call, did you have a letter from Hazel in your envelope?
Sure did. Sure did.
How did that make you feel?
Feel like I was wanted. Someone cared.
I put Hazel on the spot with you listening and said, what does she appreciate about you? How about you tell me what you appreciate about Hazel?
Well, I appreciate the quality of person that she was. She cared about me and I cared about her.
And as you look back over all these years and all these experiences, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
That I survived everything. I had a lot of tough times when I first got in, but everything turned out good. The hardest part of the war that I went through was the Battle of the Bulge. That was tough during that time. It was cold. We lived in a foxhole. It was really cold.
So is there anything in 96 years that you haven't done yet that you're still looking forward to?
No. I think I've experienced all of life.
And how about, maybe this is a tough question, but maybe you've got an answer for me. You know, because most of the people that'll hear this on the radio weren't alive during World War II. They don't know how close we were to Germany or Japan winning and how different our life would be. They didn't deal with losing buddies or losing classmates or losing the guy in the foxhole next to you. What do you think is important for us to understand? What do we need to know about you and all the other Americans who helped win World War II?
Well, we were just ordinary Army soldiers at that time. I didn't do anything extraordinary during my time in the service.
I think giving 21 years of your life to your country is pretty significant.
Well, we didn't consider it significant at the time. Now you know that you were in the service at a time where it was pretty demanding.
What do you think about when you see the flag?
I honor the flag every day of my life, every time I see a flag. The flag represents the whole United States. We were all a part of the Army or the Air Force at that time, or the branches of the service we were in. There were some very trying times during the Second World War.
I've had a lot of veterans say that they feel like America was more united then, that there wasn't as much division.
Well, that's true. They were more congealed at that time.
Okay, I've got one more question for you, and then if there's anything else that you want to say, feel free. But when I asked you what you were most proud of, you said that I survived it all, right? Well, how do you explain that? Is it luck? Do you take the credit? Do you give the credit to somebody else? What's your explanation for you getting through everything you've been through in 96 years?
I was lucky. I saw a lot of people killed. I was just lucky. Oh, I know that God was watching after me during those years. Those were some bad years. We survived them.
And what keeps you going now?
I guess just that my heart's still ticking.
Like a good watch?
Yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you for being concerned.
Phil Wright, 96 years old, and of course a big thanks to his wife of 75 years, Hazel, as well. Check out those photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time on Hometown Heroes, when we'll be reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.